Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. We're going to talk about all the films that are new on streaming services, on demand, or even reprises of films. Joining us this week are our critics. Angie Hahn is Deputy Entertainment Editor and Film Critic for Mashable, and Wade Major of Cinegods.com. First up this week on Film Week is the comedy Irresistible, starring Steve Carell, Chris Cooper, and Rose Byrne. Jon Stewart, who, of course, for many years was the host of The Daily Show, is the writer and director of Irresistible. Wade, what'd you think?
I didn't think as much as I wanted to. I do like Jon Stewart, as I think almost everyone does, and certainly respect what he was trying to do with the film. But ultimately, it feels like a watered-down, kind of not very imaginative version of Primary Colors. What Primary Colors did so well, taking you inside the moral ambiguity and the corruption of the political process, the campaigning process. This tries to do in an almost folksy homespun way with Steve Carell, you know, looking for that guy who can be the red state face of the Democratic Party, and he finds Chris Cooper in, you know, rural blue collar America, and then things start to feel very mechanical at a certain point. There's the romance, and there's the twist and the switcheroo, and it really starts to kind of fall victim to all of its own cinematic machinations.
Irresistible, the comedy from writer-director Jon Stewart. Angie, what'd you think?
Yeah, I didn't care much for it either. I mean, it was obviously it's by Jon Stewart, and it feels frozen in time from the last time that Jon Stewart was at the forefront of political comedy when he left The Daily Show in about 2015. And a lot of that has to do with the politics and the tone. It takes this glib, both sides are just as bad approach and makes observations about the divide between coastal elites and quote-unquote real Americans that would have felt stale 3 years ago, but feel especially out of touch at a time when there are protests raging in the streets in the middle of a deadly pandemic in America. Americans are having this national reckoning about race. And it also does this Adam McKay thing where sometimes the characters address us directly to explain what they're really thinking or scold us for what it presumes we're thinking, which really feels like a crutch, like it's trying to have it both ways. And then on top of all that, I don't think it really works that well as a drama or a comedy. It's not especially funny. Like, one of the jokes is that Steve Carell's character likes to eat, and that's the entire joke, which is about as interesting as it sounds. It's not, and it doesn't really get that deep into any of the characters or make you care about them. There's a good message here, but it's just buried under all the stuff that doesn't really work.
Irresistible, the comedy from writer-director Jon Stewart. It's rated R. You can see it on multiple video on demand platforms, or you can see it on the big screen of the Mission Tiki Drive-In in Montclair in the Inland Empire. The comedy Eurovision Song Contest, The Story of Fire Saga, stars Will Ferrell, who co-wrote the screenplay with Andrew Steele. Rachel McAdams co-stars in the film. David Dobkin is the director. Angie.
So this is a Netflix comedy about the Eurovision Song Contest, which of course is a real thing, and Will Ferrell and Rachel McAdams play an Icelandic duo who are not very good, but nevertheless get this once-in-a-lifetime dream opportunity to compete in this contest. And it's a little bit like a Christopher Guest mockumentary, like, you know, if you think of Best in Show or A Mighty Wind, in that it immerses you into this very particular world structured around a big event, but obviously has a very Will Ferrell sense of humor. And if you can gather from the title, the overlong title, it's very much in the vein of Talladega Nights, The Ballad of Ricky Bobby, or Anchorman, the Legend of Ron Burgundy. So if you like those, I think there's a good chance you'll like this. But Will Ferrell, I would say, is actually not the best part of it. I think it's Rachel McAdams. She's someone we've known can be a very good dramatic actor in films like Spotlight and The Notebook, but she's also very funny. I don't know if you've seen Game Night from a couple years ago, but she really got to show off a lot of her comedy chops there, and she gets to do a lot of that here. So a lot of the fun is just watching these two play off of each other in this big, over-the-top universe, and it helps that there's a lot of genuinely catchy songs. Dan Stevens plays a Russian pop singer who has an especially good one called Lion of Love that just delighted me every time it came on. I do think it's probably a little bit more interesting if you are familiar with and already a big fan of Eurovision. There's a big sequence in the middle that is one of the showstoppers of the entire movie that is just dedicated to showing off past performers, So I think there's a lot of jokes that sailed over my head since I'm not super into it. But overall, I had a good time with this one.
We're talking about the Netflix streaming comedy Eurovision Song Contest, the story of Fire Saga, co-written by Will Ferrell, who stars with Rachel McAdams. Wade, what'd you think?
Thank God for Dan Stevens. He is the shining light in this thing. If it weren't for Dan Stevens, I would have checked out well before midpoint. I normally like David Dobkin as a director. Shanghai Nights and Wedding Crashers, I thought, were a lot of fun. I think the part of the problem here is the double-edged sword of Netflix. Netflix is a very hands-off operation once movies get going. And that means that if you don't want the meddling of the development process to interfere with your artistic vision, you win. But if your movie needs a little bit more shaping and handling by that process, you wind up with something that's long and flabby. And I think this is, you know, minus credits, this clocks in just under 2 hours. With credits, it's over 2 hours. It's at least 15 or 20 minutes, way too long. So it overstays its welcome in a lot of sequences that just drag on and on and on and belabor the joke. I think Eurovision is innately very, very funny. This is sort of prime Will Ferrell territory. You know, pick an occupation, a world, and then insert Will Ferrell to create havoc and sort of magnify all of the eccentricities of that world. He's done that, like Angie said, in, you know, Ricky Bobby and everything else, ice skating. And it would be funny, I think, if it were a little bit leaner. Icelanders are very, very self-deprecating. I'm sure they won't take offense at how they're sort of depicted in this. But I do wish it had a little bit more attention to honing it down and giving it some shape and rhythm.
We're talking about Eurovision Song Contest, the story of Fire Saga. Will Ferrell, Rachel McAdams star, David Dobkin directed. It's rated PG-13. It's streaming on Netflix. That ice skating satire, Blades of Glory, was with Will Ferrell and John Hader. My Spy, an action comedy that stars Dave Bautista and Chloe Coleman. Peter Siegel, the director, and Eric Hober and John Hober, who are brothers, are the co-screenwriters. Angie, what'd you think of My Spy?
It was both a little bit better than I expected and not quite good. It's a movie that you've seen even if you haven't seen it, by which I mean it's one of those family comedies that pairs a big muscle-bound dude with a precocious kid in the tradition of Kindergarten Cop or The Pacifier. The muscle-bound dude in this case is Dave Bautista of Guardians of the Galaxy and Blade Runner 2049 and other things. And the kid is Chloe Coleman from, I think she's the most famous for Big Little Lies. And Dave Bautista plays a CIA agent who is surveilling Sophie's family, and that's how they come into each other's lives. And I know I keep talking about Dave Bautista, but he's really the best thing about this. He's a really likable performer in a lot of the other things that I've seen him in, and he makes even Drek Like Stuber from last year seem almost worth watching, and he is very likable here. He has great comic timing, he does great physical comedy, he has excellent chemistry with the kid, but he's also really winning in some of the more emotional parts, so that part of it I really liked. I also appreciated that the script's a little bit self-aware. It's a little more clever than I was expecting, but at the same time, self-awareness doesn't make up for the fact that it doesn't completely make up for the fact that it's also very, very predictable. You can see where it's coming from a mile away. And that's not always the worst thing, but it is a movie that I walked out of thinking, well, that was fine. If I were watching it with a kid, that would be a good reason to watch it, but I can't really imagine a reason to tell an adult to watch it by themselves. Mostly, it just made me hope that Dave Bautista can get some better roles in the future.
It's rated PG-13. My Spy is the action comedy. Wade, what'd you think?
I enthusiastically second everything Angie just said. It's spot on. I love Dave Bautista, but man, this just went to the well for every single one of those cliches from the muscular guy with the kid that outsmarts them, and then it's got the romance folded in, and you kind of know where every single beat and turning point is going to come here. She's right. You've seen this movie, even if you haven't seen it, you just know it in your genes. And it's kind of unfortunate. Peter Siegel has been a good comedy director before. Tommy Boy, we all love Tommy Boy. But it's been a long time since he's kind of really stuck the landing. He Gets Smart and 50 First Dates, they all kind of miss it a little bit. And I think this one has the same problem. It's just kind of missing the mark, and it's too bad because Dave Bautista really has great comic timing.
My Spy, the action comedy, is rated PG-13. You can see it at the drive-in, at the Vineland in the City of Industry, at the Van Buren in Riverside, and the Mission Tiki in Montclair. It's also available streaming at home on Amazon Prime Video. My Spy, again, is rated PG-13. Our Film Week critics next up are going to look at the documentary The Ghost of Peter Sellers, directed by Peter Medic. Wade, what did you think?
I think this is absolutely amazing. This is an extraordinary kind of documentary. It's more of a personal memoir of sorts. Peter Medak, you know, who's made tons of just extraordinary movies. He's originally a Hungarian filmmaker, but he came of age in 1972 with The Ruling Class and Peter O'Toole, and that really just vaulted him to the forefront of A-list directors at the time. And he would later go on to do everything from comedies like Zorro the Gay Blade to dramas like Let Him Have It. Really just a superb filmmaker, but he's been troubled all these years by the film that came on the heels of The Ruling Class, which was Ghost in the Noonday Sun, a pirate comedy that he was supposed to make in 1973 with Peter Sellers that turned into one of the all-time movie catastrophes. And he practically has PTSD from the experience. And so Peter Medak has decided to go and reconcile himself to the ghosts. What went wrong? Why did this film go so south? And why is it still so stuck in his psyche that he can't get over it? And he goes back to all of the people who are still alive who were part of it, the financiers and the producers, and tries to reconstruct what went wrong. And it is absolutely fascinating, not just from a filmmaking standpoint of how a movie can go wrong, even if the people making it are presumably competent, in which case Peter Sellers is just out of his mind and impossible to work with, but it also gives you the insight into the fragility of the artistic mindset, that even if you are a completely capable filmmaker, you're still perfectly capable of being pulled apart if circumstances don't come just right. I really loved it.
The Ghost of Peter Sellers documentary from director Peter Medic. What did you think, Angie?
I think I was less emotionally taken with it than Wade was, but I really appreciated what it was doing. It's a really interesting spin on the documentary, on that subgenre of documentaries about films that never got made. I think I've seen Lost in La Mancha and Jodorowsky's Dune reference a lot when people are talking about this movie. But because it's being directed by the person who tried to make the original movie, it adds this interesting layer. And in that sense, the movie that I was thinking of while I was watching this, it's very different, but I was thinking of Sandy Tan's Shirkers, because that's another movie where having the person who originally made the movie talk about this movie all these years later with the perspective of that added time just adds a really interesting level to it. So I think Peter Sellers kind of, it's a fun movie if you want to hear wild stories about the crazy stuff that Peter Sellers got up to on set. There's a scene that I really enjoyed where Medak is talking to other directors that he worked with, and they're just talking about how even when it was great, even when they're making good movies with him, it was just miserable working with him. So in that sense, it's really amusing. But one of the things that I really appreciated about it is that it understands that he was not the ultimate villain. He's not the only reason that this movie didn't happen. It's a movie that they are pretty frank about the fact that it probably should not have gotten made, or at least not at the point that it was made, when it clearly just wasn't ready to go. It seems like the movie was kind of cursed from the start when the pirate ship that they had spent all this time and money building ran aground because of a drunken captain. So what it really left me with was this appreciation that it's a minor miracle anytime a movie actually does get made, with all the moving parts and all the things that can go wrong and all the kind of egos and artistic visions coming together to form something coherent.
The Ghost of Peter Sellers documentary by Peter Medak about his experience making the 1973 pirate comedy Ghost in the Noonday Sun with younger Peter Sellers, up-and-coming filmmaker with an actor who had quite the reputation Medak was trying to work with. The film is unrated. You can see it on multiple video-on-demand platforms. They include Amazon Prime Video, Google Play, and YouTube. it's unrated. Now, coming up in just a minute, we'll talk about the HBO documentary Welcome to Chechnya, which takes us to the Russian Republic of Chechnya and the film following LGBTQ activists as they work undercover to rescue victims and provide them with safe houses, among other assistance. We'll hear about that, as well as the documentary No Small Matter about early childhood education. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC and the KPECC app. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC, kpecc.org, and smart speakers. All you need to do is ask it for Film Week. Next up with our critics, Angie Hahn and Wade Major, Welcome to Chechnya, an HBO documentary, which is directed by David France. Wade, please start us.
This is an absolutely riveting and harrowing documentary about a network of LGBT activists in Chechnya who, where, because it is an extremely conservative Muslim population and it is run by an autocrat who is effectively handpicked by Vladimir Putin, there is cultural... basically a cultural dictatorship layered underneath the political dictatorship. You are expected to behave a certain way, to adhere to certain cultural norms, one of which is if you are openly gay, you will be, at worst, murdered, at best, routinely beaten. In one case, there's a pop singer whose sexuality is suspect, and he disappears, and he still hasn't been heard from. So this is about a network that is almost kind of like an invisible, you know, an underground railroad that is there to help people who whose families might be at risk of their families, at risk of political persecution, to help them get out of the country. And it becomes almost like a thriller at a certain point, like a political thriller. You are taken right inside all of the machinations and the spy network and the spycraft that goes on to actually pull this off. And it's utterly fascinating. The thing that's there are two things I would say. One that's a little disconcerting and one that's a little bit artistically off-putting. One is that they can't quite focus on this. They can't choose the story that they need to focus on. There are about three interconnected stories here, and each of them kind of interfere with the other one right when they're starting to get you completely wrapped up in the events. They derail over to the side and take a little bit of a detour, which is understandable. They want to tell all the stories. They just don't quite get the balance right. The other one is that you have to be concerned that by making this film, have they, in point of fact, undermined what it is that they're doing? Have they sort of tipped their hand to these authorities? And I don't have an answer to that, and I don't think anyone does, but it is a question you're left with.
We're talking about the HBO documentary Welcome to Chechnya, which begins airing on HBO Tuesday of this coming week. Angie, what'd you think of the film?
Yeah, to Wade's second point, it's a movie that makes you wonder. It's one of those documentaries where you wonder how it even got made, because they tell you over and over that secrecy is of the utmost importance. These are people who are literally fleeing the country to save their own lives. So it makes you wonder how did we even get this footage? I read in an interview that a lot of it was apparently the director posing as a tourist, which got him a lot of leeway with authorities whenever he did run into them. But the other thing that they do is use, I guess it's similar to deepfake technology, where they digitally alter the faces and voices of a lot of the subjects, most of them, by swapping them with actors who are, you know, not these people. And it has an odd effect. At first, I wasn't really sure. You can tell sometimes the VFX works better than others. So sometimes it's very obvious that what you're seeing is not entirely a real person. Other times it's more convincing and you're not really sure if you're looking at it. So it can be a little bit unsettling at times. And it took me a little while to get used to, but I ultimately think that was a choice that is probably preferable to other ways that they might have had of trying to tell these people's stories while also protecting their identity. I imagine that this was a better option than, for example, putting them in shadow or blurring out their faces. And it also leads to one of the most powerful moments in the entire documentary, which is when one of the subjects decides that he's actually going to come forward and reveal his identity, and then you just see the digital effects melt away, and you finally get to really see him for the first time. And I thought that that was a point that really just tied the whole thing together and hammers home exactly how desperate the situation is for these people, the lengths that they have to go to protect themselves, and how brave it is for them to be speaking out at all about any of the stuff that's happening to them. So as Wade says, it's a little bit all over the place, but ultimately I found this to be such a harrowing, fascinating watch.
The HBO documentary Welcome to Chechnya is directed by David France. It's unrated. It starts showing on HBO Tuesday and is available on HBO's On Demand site on Wednesday of this coming week. The documentary No Small Matter, directed by Danny Alpert, Greg Jacobs, and John Siskel, looks at early child care and early education. Wade.
Really, really good, and so important at this particular point in time, because we aren't, you know, with so much focus on social problems and how to resolve them, I think everyone is looking to put a Band-Aid on it or to wag the dog by addressing how do we deal with adults, and no one is really looking at where the problems begin, which is in those first 5 years of life when brains are developing. And good on Alfre Woodard, who narrates this and executive produced it and is kind of the face and the power behind getting it out. It's a very engaging documentary about the science behind early childhood development and why it is so important to get it right, because if kids get to 5, 6, 7 years old without having fed their development correctly, you may very well have lost them permanently or at least substantially in their lives. And that, of course, feeds into economic inequality and political problems and crime rates and gentrification and so many other issues. And if you go down to the root of it, if you get this right, those other problems can be addressed and can be possibly eliminated. That's basically the theme of the film. And I thought it did an absolutely superb and very entertaining job of doing it, not in that very dry talking head way, which they get out of the way immediately just in the first few seconds. They let you know this is going to be an entertaining and engaging way of addressing a very serious subject. And as the father of an elementary school age daughter, I have seen this discussion up close and personal for the last several years, and I really, really do think that this is vital for anyone that has kids in the system, anyone that expects to have kids in the system, anyone who wants to sort of go to the root of where a lot of these problems we're talking about now originate.
No Small Matter, documentary directed by Danny Alpert, Greg Jacobs, and John Siskel. Alfre Woodard is the narrator, and the movie's unrated. You can see it on demand with Amazon Prime Video, iTunes, or Google Play. The South Korean drama House of Hummingbirds is written and directed by Bora Kim. Angie?
Yeah, I found this to be a really lovely, sensitive coming-of-age drama about a working-class 14-year-old girl named Eun-hee growing up in Seoul in 1994. And it's a kind of movie where I want to say not a lot happens in it, but it's not actually true. So over the course of the year, this character deals with death and illness and sexual awakening, family drama, abuse, and meanwhile in the backdrop, you know, South Korea is rapidly industrializing, and there are big events that are referenced in the movie, like the collapse of the Cheongsu Bridge and the death of North Korean dictator Kim Il-sung. So there's a lot going on here, but the reason it kind of feels in some ways like it, not that much happening, is that she takes this really slow, sensitive, patient approach. Director Bora Kim avoids sensationalizing or editorializing or waxing nostalgic about the past. Instead, she takes this really observant approach to the story, and in doing so, she picks up these little details in ways that feel all the richer because she's not spoon-feeding them to you. Like she's content to just let the camera sit on the characters while they are processing something that's just happened, or thinking about the next move, or just waiting to be noticed. And I think this works really well, especially because Eun-hee, the main character, is such a lonely, solitary character who feels overlooked by everyone in the world, including her own family. But making us sit like this with her really helps us build this intimate connection with her. And, you know, the downside of this kind of filmmaking is that it does take time, so this movie clocks in 140 minutes, and it does feel slow sometimes, but I think it pays off in the end because it feels like you're really living this life with her. I mean, to me, that approach was reminiscent of something like Hirosaku Koreeda in that sense of patience and the way that the world feels really lived in and its lack of sentimentality. So I think between the relative slowness and the long runtime, it might not be for everyone, but I think it's absolutely worth seeking out if you want to see some exciting new talent in the form of this director and also the lead actress, Park Ju.
House of Hummingbird, South Korean drama, Wade.
Yeah, I agree. Angie nailed it spot on. It is the kind of film the critics typically call deliberate, which is a nice way of saying it's slow, but it's worth your time. It's worth sitting down and letting it kind of soak in. It's nice that the success of Parasite has sort of opened up opportunities for more Korean films to come over here. And the thing is, you know, like any other major industry, like Japan, like Hong Kong, like France or Italy, South Korea has many different traditions and genres in its filmmaking. And one of them, is, you know, Parasite is obviously one school, but there is this school of very slow, very thoughtful, Kore-eda type films, which of course you get from Japan and elsewhere too, and this is one of those. It's not going to rush the story, and you do let it kind of wash over you. The cast is wonderful. Ji-Hoo Park is really a very, very nuanced actress, and it's very effective. It takes its time. You know, you really have to stick with it. I think for about the first 40 minutes, some people might start to get a little bit impatient, but hang in there. It'll pay off.
The film is House of Hummingbird. It's unrated, and you can see it on the Frida Virtual Cinema and on Google Play. The Last Tree, a British drama written and directed by Shola Amoh. Wade?
What a beautiful movie. This is from Art Matin Productions, which is a new upstart distributor. This film premiered at Sundance. It is being a little bit superficially called the English or the British Moonlight. I don't think that's really quite fair. The only thing it really has in common with Moonlight is that they are two films by black filmmakers that tell semi-autobiographical stories in three life chapters. Apart from that, they are not at all the same. The last chapter here is played, you know, it's only two actors here, not three, and the last chapter is really more of a coda. Shola Amoh is a Nigerian-British filmmaker. After many very good shorts, this is his feature debut, and it is very impressive. It is a very poetic but telling story of a young man who of Nigerian roots, the son of a Nigerian immigrant, who is initially raised by a foster mother, an English foster mother in the countryside, and then his Nigerian mother reclaims him at a certain point to raise him in London, and he is at that point subject to a rather extraordinary cultural clashes in his own sense of identity. Who is he? Where does he belong? The countryside versus the city versus Nigerian. All of these things kind of collide in his soul, and he becomes this very restless and internally ambiguous person. And it is about that journey, which involves being part immigrant, part, you know, not really knowing where you belong in the society and in the world. And it's told so beautifully. It has an absolutely wonderful score, incredible sound design. It is visually just absolutely arresting. And the performance by the actor who plays him as a young man, Samuel Adewunmi, is incredible. He is an extraordinary actor. He is magnetic. You can't take your eyes off him, and it will bring you to tears in at least two or three places.
The Last Tree, British drama written and directed by Shola Amoh. It's unrated on Lemley's Virtual Cinema and the Frida Virtual Cinema. The documentary Ella Fitzgerald, Just One of Those Things, is directed by Leslie Woodhead. Angie?
This is a lovely tribute to a great woman that gets at exactly what made her such a singular figure in American music, which is not just her talent, but also her powerful charisma, her omnivorousness, her versatility, her ambition. It also offers a lot of context about the culture that helped make someone like her possible, but also the culture that sometimes stood in her way. And it just moves through her biography in chronological orders, broken up into chapters. And in doing so, I think it really reminds us that a lot of the conversations we're having about white Americans loving black culture but not black people have been going on for a really long, long time. And the admiration that this documentary has for Ella Fitzgerald is palpable. It also has a lot of her music, which makes it so that this is kind of just automatically entertaining. But that said, 6 decades of her career is a large amount of time to cover in 90 minutes. So it does end up feeling more like a jumping off point for deeper exploration than a deeper exploration in and of itself.
Wade, you got about 30 seconds for Ella Fitzgerald, Just One of Those Things?
I think Angie nailed it. What I appreciated is that normally the crooners, and especially the jazz singers of this generation, whether it's Dinah Washington or Judy Garland or Billie Holiday, they're so troubled and they're so angst-ridden. And you know what? Ella has it together, and it's so reassuring to see that story told, too.
And don't forget Sarah Vaughan. Ella Fitzgerald, just one of those things, unrated. Lemley's Virtual Cinema, Leslie Woodhead, the director. And wait, I know you definitely want to bring up the digital restoration of 1995's Shanghai Triad by Zhang Yimou.
Yes, Zhang Yimou did an absolutely masterful job with Shanghai Triad, which is now on virtual cinema through Film Movement. Go to filmmovement.com. Really an extraordinary recreation of the gangster dramas that took place in the streets of 1920s Shanghai. It's an absolute must-see, one of the most visually arresting films ever made.
Starring Gong Li. Rated R, Shanghai Triad, Film Movement, Virtual Cinema. And then next Friday, Lemley's Virtual and the Frida Virtual Cinemas as well. Our critics joining us this week, Wade Major and Angie Han. Coming up, we'll talk about the future of movie theaters with The Frame's John Horn.